Simon & Schuster Audio presents Johnny Mnemonic, a novelization by Terry Bisson from a screenplay by William Gibson, read by Jack Noseworthy.
I'm here.
Johnny was talking to himself as much as to the face that was resolving itself on the vidphone. Here, Beijing, city of light and air, so different from run-down, played-out, used-up America. Above Beijing's boulevards, glass-steel towers soared into alluring formations, their video-generated curves augmented by hollow-enhanced cakering that glowed by night and shimmered by day. It was beautiful.
Here. Where's here, Johnny?
Beijing, Ralphie. I'm in a cab downtown. You got me on a car phone. I'm on my way to the hotel. Ralphie looked worried.
Did you get the upgrade?
Sure I did. The cab stopped suddenly with a sickening lurch. Johnny almost slid off the seat. A hand suddenly slapped against the rear window of the cab. Blood smeared down the glass. Things were definitely getting wilder. Johnny leaned to see through the thick side window. A jerking line of demonstrators, their faces hidden behind surgical masks, was surging onto the boulevard. Steel drums boomed under a forest of sticks and banners. The front line of demonstrators wore helmets, and two rows of police were falling back as they advanced. Most of the banners were in Chinese, but others were in Arabic, Russian, Spanish, and English. They read, "Stop NAS! No NAS! Where's the cure?" The demonstrators had that zombie-like gait, the twitching limbs and the empty stares of those already afflicted with the disease. Ralphie's voice crackled out of the vidphone.
What's all that racket, Johnny? What's going on?
Some kind of demonstration of NAS. You know, nerve attenuation syndrome?
There too?
A demonstrator clambered over the hood of the cab, followed by another. Others pushed into the sides. The cars behind started to honk, their horns and sirens raising a wail over the beating of steel drums and the rail of the crowd. Johnny turned back to the grimy screen. NAS is everywhere, Ralphie. Read the fucking papers. But don't look so worried. We have our job here. It's under control.
This is a big one, Johnny. You sure you could carry it? I mean, I could send out this new guy who's fitted with the latest...
Ralphie, stop it. I got upgraded with the MDA-18 this morning. Johnny hoped the lie sounded convincing. Now the cab was rocking back and forth as the crowd vented its anger on the foreign object in its midst. Johnny pulled two bills from his pocket and gave them to the driver. He picked up his briefcase and reached for the door handle. Ralphie's voice rose in protest.
Where you going?
I'll walk.
Walk?
Ralphie's butts were lost in the din of shouts and screams, police sirens, and cracking billy clubs as Johnny slid open the cab door. With only a second's hesitation, Johnny straightened his tie, composed his features into a perfect blank, and plunged into the maelstrom. Johnny walked through the crowd in his dark business suit, eyes straight ahead, benign smile. His studied, formal politeness was as effective as a police escort. So effective that he made it for almost a block before getting stopped. A demonstrator leaped in front of him from the side of an overturned car. He was holding up a sign that read, "Stop NAS now! No more delays! Release the cure!" He was screaming in Chinese through a surgical mask stained with blood and spittle. Johnny tried to pass, but the man blocked his way. The man's feet were wrapped in filthy bandages. In the half-light of evening, they were stitching their way from side to side on the pavement in a macabre dance, the death shuffle of those in the last stages of NAS. Then Johnny saw a police cutter nosing through the crowd like a blue shark. He vaulted up and over its narrow hood while two rows of riot cops filed out of the back like paratroopers, masked in black lucite, eagerly slapping their palms with heavy plastic stun clubs. Time to get scarce, Johnny told himself. He hit the street on the other side of the cutter, running. The crowd was running too, screaming. There were shouts, groans, the sickening crack of dense plastic on bone. When he had reached the end of the street, Johnny looked at his watch, then up at the ideograph above the street a few blocks ahead. Under it were the words, Beijing Ramada. Barely late, he thought, slipping around the corner toward the brightly lighted hotel entrance. From the 25th floor of the Beijing Ramada, the world's second largest city was a sea of lights, like a Milky Way beached on a dark planet. It seemed to be a high-res video display of pure information, digital, a landscape of light and dark, without the grayscale complications of flesh and blood. The complications are what we live for, thought the young Vietnamese scientist as he closed his eyes and conjured up an image of his wife and child. He shuddered as he thought of how much he loved them, and how much he was risking for an abstract humanity. He turned to the older man, also Vietnamese, standing beside him. Both were dressed conservatively in dark blue suits. The young man looked worried. The courier is late. Be calm, the older one replied. Calm. The young man retreated from the window and surveyed the hotel room behind him. What he saw made him even more nervous. To him, they were not people. The four Koreans sharing the suite had been hired for their lethal, not their social, skills. They were killers. Their leader, dressed in a speed racer t-shirt and sweatpants, was as large as a sumo wrestler. He was frying shrimp on a charcoal hibachi set up on the coffee table. His male partner was channel surfing on the TV, flipping boredly past news reports of the riot in the streets below, and finally settling on a Japanese superhero cartoon. The other two Korean bodyguards were women. One was short-haired and muscular, wearing a bathrobe and cleaning her 9mm Glock semi-automatic pistol with a Q-tip. The other leafed through a month-old copy of Glamour that she could just as easily have been in, with her perfect hair and makeup. She wore a Victoria's Secret robe, with other elegant secrets underneath, among them a .357 Magnum. The young Vietnamese scientist leaned closer to his older colleague.
Why is he late? We should have put it out on the global net while there was still time. No. It would have been suicide. They are monitoring every fragment of transmitted data. A courier is the only way. So we hire a criminal with a silicone chip in his head? A highly skilled smuggler. Besides, it was she who chose him, just as she chose us. You must remember that.
The courier wasn't the only one who was late. A few blocks away, in a limousine trapped behind the riot police, six conservatively dressed business people waited in traffic. Five were men and one was a woman. They sat wordless, with blank faces and seemingly infinite patience. Only the fingers drumming on the gym bags held in their laps betrayed the tension in the slowly creeping limo. They were professional operatives for the world's largest, most whispered about, most feared and most profitable criminal organization, the Coca-Cola of crime. They were Yakuza. The man in the right front seat, Shinji, was the youngest and at the same time the hardest looking of the six. He was a Japanese-American, as neatly tailored as the others, but with a ponytail hanging over the back collar of his expensive gray suit. The limo crept a few more feet around a corner, and he found what he was looking for. A neon hollow, floating high above faux crenellated towers. The Beijing Ramada. One whole wall of the Beijing Ramada's lobby was taken up with television monitors, scanning leisurely from channel to channel as sensors picked up how many eyes were on each screen. Thus, the guests in the lobby indirectly and collectively controlled the display. No one was watching now but a 5-year-old boy and a grizzled veteran in a worn but carefully pressed People's Red Army uniform. Thus, half the monitors showed news footage from the NAS riots, and the other half showed a violent Japanese superhero cartoon. Johnny stopped just inside the revolving doors, looking for his contact. He soon noticed the well-dressed Chinese man standing by a potted fern, reading, "Let's Go China 2020. Last year's edition, as arranged." Johnny walked over and bowed.
"Let's have it quick. I'm running late."
The man smiled back and handed Johnny a white paper bag. In Chinese and English, it read, "Dunkin' Donuts." Johnny looked inside and frowned, then smiled even more politely.
"You promised me an MDA-18. I paid for a fucking MDA 18.
The Chinese man shrugged, still smiling.
Look, pal, that's a Pemex doubler. The guy who supplied it said that it should give you almost the same capacity as the MDA 18. Almost? It's not even close.
The Chinese man reached for the donut bag.
Look, if you don't want it...
Johnny sighed and folded the bag over.
He bowed politely.
It'll have to do.
The Chinese man bowed just as politely and closed his book. Just as he was about to walk away, a sudden, subtle change in the light made both men turn and look behind them. The monitors on the wall were all changing one by one. Instead of repeating the same images, they were each presenting part of a single, larger image. A young black man wearing dreadlocks and mirror shades. The Chinese man pointed.
J-Bone.
Who?
Leader of the Lotex. Video gorilla stuff.
Johnny had heard of them. The video gorillas known as the Lotex had the uncanny capacity to break into any programming, network or cable, satellite or fiber optic, with their anti-establishment message. But what's the point, Johnny wondered. What do they gain by it?
You'll snatch back your brain, zombie. Snatch it back and hold it.
Then his face, distorted with rage and passion, was replaced by the peaceful image of a dolphin gliding across the screen in perfect silence. Gliding, gliding, then gone. The news and the cartoon were back. Default mode. The buzz was back. The rattle and hum. The crowd in the lobby picked up where it had left off. The low-tech intrusions were obviously part of the normal TV matrix everywhere. Johnny headed over to the bank of elevators and stepped inside one, punching 25. As the doors slid shut, he set down his briefcase and opened the donut bag. The Pemex doubler was about the size of a deck of cards. It was transparent green plastic with gold circuitry embedded inside. There was an LCD display at one end and a short extension phone jack at the other. Johnny hefted the tiny device. Would it be enough? Only one way to find out. He pushed back the hair over his left ear, exposing a small, surgically implanted female phone jack. As he inserted the male end of the doubler into the female jack wet-wired into his skull, Johnny's eyes closed briefly in a short, sharp spasm of pleasure. Or was it pain? Or apprehension? He didn't have the time to sort it out for himself, even if he had been so inclined. Work to do. The elevator display read 6. The LCD display on the device read, RAM upload ready. Then, RAM upload begin. Johnny rode with his eyes closed, his mind a careful blank. This was a simple procedure, the addition of temporary RAM. But he didn't want to risk a crash or a lockup. It could be painful, or dangerous if interrupted. Plus, there was no time. It was almost pleasant. Uploading cold RAM didn't hold the thrill of jacking through cyberspace. But Johnny felt a certain peace, rare for him. It turned his consciousness inward. It was like wandering through an empty house after everyone had moved out. It was the abandoned house of his own memories. There was a strange sense of peace, an unfamiliar but pleasant sensation for a man who lived, as he did, so close to the edge. Johnny unjacked the Pemex doubler and dropped it back into the donut sack. The elevator door opened. Johnny stepped into the carpeted hallway and dropped the donut sack into a potted plant by the elevator. He checked that his hair was back in place. He straightened his tie. He adjusted his smile. In suite 2571, all 4 Korean bodyguards jumped to their feet when the doorbell rang. Ancient but effective and intimidating. Gunpowder, projectile guns. The sumo guy walked to the door, a sawed-off 12-gauge in his hand. The fashion model joined him, the miniaturized 357 almost visible under her open robe. The sumo bodyguard opened the door. Johnny stepped into the room where he was confronted by the younger of the 2 scientists.
You are late, Mr. Smith.
The older scientist stepped forward and held out a sealed envelope.
Everything is taken care of. Here is your ticket. Suborbital to Newark. First class, as arranged.
Johnny put the envelope into the inside pocket of his suit. First, let's see what you guys want to upload. The older scientist nodded to the younger, who went into the bedroom. Johnny set his briefcase on the coffee table and took out a small electronic device. He crossed to the door and stuck the device to the door frame with two-sided tape. A tiny red light on the side started blinking. "Motion detector," Johnny explained, "in case the natives get restless." The blinking light was echoed by an even smaller red light on a beeper-like device on Johnny's belt. The younger scientist came back into the room carrying a tiny black box. He pulled out a CD-ROM disc the size of an antique U.S. Buffalo nickel. Johnny eyed it. "So that's it? How much am I carrying?"
320 gigabytes.
"You mean megabytes." The older scientist spoke from across the room.
"No, gigabytes."
Johnny tried not to betray his surprise and concern, but he wasn't entirely successful. The old man leveled a steady gaze at Johnny.
"Are you sure you have enough storage capacity, Mr. Smith? It's extremely dangerous if you don't. If the upload volume exceeds your storage capacity, synaptic seepage will kill you in 2 days. Plus, the data will be corrupted. A coherent download will be impossible."
Johnny cut him off. "You don't need to tell me my business. Are we uploading or not?" The older man nodded.
"As soon as you are ready, your agent will contact you in Newark and arrange the meeting for the download."
"Perfect. Let's boogie." Or bust, he thought to himself. He sat on the sofa in front of the coffee table and opened his briefcase. He took out a roll of lifesavers, a credit card, a pair of sunglasses. He took the sunglasses out of the case and set them aside. Then, with practiced hands, he snapped the case into two unequal pieces. He pulled a gold rod from the smaller piece and used it to join the pieces. He slid the card into a slot on the large piece, then inserted the roll of candy into the end of the unit, locking it into place with half a twist to the left. The older man looked on with a thin smile, his confidence in his courier growing. Johnny pulled a thin cable from the bottom of it and, pushing back his hair, inserted it into his wet wired temple jack. He set the upload device on the table and picked up the TV remote from the couch. Pointing the remote first at the upload device, then at the TV, Johnny reprogrammed it by punching in a few numbers. Then he handed the remote to the younger of the two scientists. "This remote is keyed in now. Watch the counter on the upload device, here. And when the counter approaches zero, click on any three frames off the TV. They'll meld with your data and I won't know what they are. Those three images are your download code. Got it?" The young man nodded. "You'll get a hard copy here. Fax a copy of that to your connection in Newark or wherever, and when I get there, they feed in the three image code and download. Delivery done. Okay? Capiche? You got it? Comprende? Understand?" The young man nodded.
Good.
"Now, give me your shit." The young man handed Johnny the CD-ROM, and Johnny slipped it into the top of the upload device. It spun, then stopped. 320,000 appeared on the counter. Johnny pointed toward a button on the top of the upload device. "Press that to start the upload, okay? It'll stop on its own. Hopefully." Johnny put some drops in his eyes and looked around the room one more time before putting on his sunglasses. Then he leaned back on the couch and popped a tooth protector into his mouth. "Hit me." The young man pressed the button. The tiny bright disc became a silver blur. At that precise moment, 25 floors straight down, the six Yakuza walked to the elevator bank. Shinji pressed the button with his thumb, or rather, with the metal cap on the end of his thumb. The Yakuza's faces fell into the wait mode, all except for one, an American named Henson.
"Shinji!"
"What is it, Henson?"
"These guys upstairs, who are they?"
"Scientists. Research and development guys from Pharmacon."
Henson's eyes brightened.
"Defectors?"
"Forget that,"
Shinji warned.
"Tokyo wants the data. Remember that."
The elevator doors opened. They stepped inside. Navigating cyberspace is one thing. Mainlining it is another. As a cowboy, inserting himself into a program, Johnny was in control, and he could articulate his consciousness through the virtual reality of the electronic matrix. as naturally as a fish swims in water. But mainlining, receiving an upload, was more like being a leaf on a raging stream, a speck in a rushing flood of digital information. It is the opposite of inserting yourself into a program. You are inserting raw data into yourself. And it comes all at once, in a howling, uncompiled, uncodified, unformatted, incomprehensible raw files and naked subroutines, protocols and archives, macros and heaps and sequences. A digital cyclone that is scary as hell, even to hardwired veteran cybernetic couriers like Johnny. Johnny was terrified. Pyramids and formulas flew by, howling. Circles and proofs and sharp-featured squares, ungeometric, neo-geometric, and super-geometric. Shapes that shifted and equations that screamed. Icons and elements in every color of the rainbow, plus several that had never made reality release. Molecular models in three and four dimensions and more. TIFF towers, custom characters and CDEV codes in Arabic and Japanese, numeric and English, ASCII and Greek. Johnny tried to quell or at least control his terror, but it grew as the tsunami of data grew. Too many things were happening too fast. It was an unassimilable flood of data, murderous and still increasing. Johnny knew his only chance was to let go, to go under and ride it out, let it take him. He let go. He screamed. It didn't help. Then his scream screamed, and screamed, and screamed his scream, and screamed his scream.
You think he's okay?
The young Vietnamese scientist was standing over Johnny, who was lying rigid on the sofa, his eyes clamped shut, his face a death mask. Johnny's low groans filled the room. The older scientist shrugged.
I guess he does this for a living. He must know what he's doing. Shouldn't you be getting ready to click on the images for the download code?
Snapping out of his reverie, the younger pointed the remote at the TV screen. A Japanese cartoon figure was drop-kicking a bad guy from this world into the next. Click. As the image was booked, the channel changed automatically from the cartoon to a commercial featuring a middle-aged Chinese man speaking in Mandarin and holding up a bottle of pills. Suddenly, amazingly, his body began to morph into a woman's face. The camera drew in on her features. It was a European or American face with brown eyes, soft but commanding, yin and yang earrings. A woman in her 50s. Click. The face disappeared and the image was booked, even though the younger scientist hadn't meant to hit the remote. The younger man turned to his partner.
Did you see that?
See what?
It was her!
Hurry. We need one more. Get your third image.
The younger man aimed the remote at the TV without even looking to see what was on the screen. Click.
That's three.
The younger man looked at the courier on the sofa, who was vibrating all over like a reed in the wind. He looked at the tiny display on the upload device. It read, 3-part download code complete.
Got it?
The old Viet asked.
I think so.
The upload device whirred and extruded a 12-inch long strip of thermal paper. The younger scientist tore it off. He looked at it, then placed it face down on the table.
The access code. 3 images. Mr. Smith.
Johnny opened his eyes. Darkness.
Mr. Smith, are you all right?
Johnny lifted his sunglasses. There was the younger of the two Vietnamese scientists bending over him, looking concerned. The upload. It had worked. He focused on the client's face.
Did you get your code clicked in?
The young scientist nodded.
Good. Fax it to the other end. I don't want to see it.
Johnny pulled the jack out of his head and smoothed his hair back down into place. He looked at his watch. The upload had taken only 6 minutes. 6 minutes for enough data to choke a brontosaurus, Johnny thought. His head felt as if it would burst. He wiped his nose and was surprised to see a thin smear of blood on the back of his hand.
Where's your bathroom?
Johnny looked at himself in the bathroom mirror.
Jesus!
He said to himself.
What the hell have I done? Ugh, too much data. 320 gigs, way too much.
He splashed water on his face.
How long did the old man say? A day or two? Synaptic seepage. Oh, shit.
Maybe if he moved fast enough and downloaded soon enough, everything would be all right. What's taking him so long? The younger Vietnamese scientist wondered, glancing toward the bathroom door.
Quit worrying, he told himself. The first stage was done, successful. Now to destroy the evidence. He popped the nickel-sized CD-ROM out of the upload device. He picked it up with a pair of chopsticks and held it over the charcoal hibachi fire. The older Vietnamese scientist was across the room, turning on the fax machine. In his hand, he held the thermal paper with the three codes. Shinji unscrewed the cap off his prosthetic thumb and held it between his teeth. A thin loop of silver filament extruded from the open end of the thumb. The filament was far thinner than a spider's web. It floated like smoke. Shinji flipped his thumb, and the filament flashed down toward the doorknob of room 2571. Soundlessly, the knob and lock fell forward, bringing with them an oval piece of wood, scooped from the solid oak of the door like ice cream. The lock assembly hit the carpet with a soft thud. Johnny was about to step out of the bathroom when he heard a small sound. Behind him? No, below him. It was on his belt. The red light. The motion detector. The sawed-off matte black 10-gauge went off, both barrels in quick succession, followed by the blast of the pearl-handled miniaturized .357. It wasn't that the aim of the .357's owner, the fashion model, was poor. It was just that by the time she got her shot off, she was already falling backward, one side of her face gone. It wasn't that the sumo guy had meant to shoot her with the 10-gauge. It was just that the rain of plastic pellets that set him spinning backwards had caused him to fire wildly just before they sent him through the picture window, falling to the faux cobblestones of the shopping mall 25 floors below. At the first shot, the channel surfer dropped the remote and picked up his Tech 9 with one swift motion. But the tech-type vests of the Yakuza deflected the rain of the 7.62 expanders. The Yakuza focused their air pistol fire on the couch, enveloping the channel surfer in a small cloud of blood and dacro fluff couch stuffing. It was over in 6.8 seconds. The tattooed lady never even got her Glock put together. The younger scientist crouched over the hibachi, watching the CD-ROM soften and sag and drop into the fire to be consumed. Relieved, he closed his eyes, waiting for the shot that would do as much for him. Henson, the American Yakuza, stepped forward and raised his air gun toward the back of the younger scientist's head. Shinji stopped the American with a shake of his head. The defecting scientist had destroyed the CD-ROM. That meant he had done something else with the data. Perhaps a courier. Shinji pointed with his chin towards the closed bathroom door. Henson crossed the room and reached for the knob. The door opened a crack. A hand reached through, and stubby, scarred fingers searched for the light switch. Something gleamed in the sliver of light from the other room. An upper Montclair High School ring. Johnny let the fingers find the switch before slamming the door hard. He heard the muddled crunch of cartilage and tendon, and the sharper, more satisfying snap of bone. He flung the door open and pulled the American in, flinging him in one easy motion through the old-fashioned sliding glass door into the shower stall. Johnny picked up one of the shards of broken glass from the floor and used it as a mirror to look around the corner of the door into the suite. It was less than a pleasant scene. The Korean bodyguards were scattered about the room in bloody heaps. Two of the Yakuza stood over the younger Vietnamese scientist, who was huddled over the hibachi, his eyes closed. The older Vietnamese scientist stood silently over the fax machine, motionless as a deer, watching the strip of thermal paper with the access codes being absorbed slowly, line by line. Codes the Yakuza mustn't get! Johnny dropped the glass and lunged out of the bathroom at the same time as the Yakuza in the doorway stepped forward, right thumb held high. Johnny grabbed the paper just as Shinji whipped his thumb in a tight circle. The filament cut through the air without a sound, cut through the fax machine and the table that held it, cut through the paper, just as Johnny pulled it loose. The paper was sliced clean. All he had was one image. The old scientist held the other two, and with a sudden, swift motion, he dove for the hibachi. Shinji's thumb jerked upward, the filament flashed and flew, and the old man's hand holding the paper fell, severed onto the glowing bed of coals. The paper was just starting to burn, and the old man was just starting to smile, as the Yakuza's third swing of the filament sliced him in half, on an angle, from his right collar to his left hip. He slipped to the floor in two pieces, still smiling. Air pistols make little noise, only a whisper, followed by the soft of multi-barbed plastic darts. In the almost silent room, Johnny dove for the door as the rain of darts ticked into the wall behind him. He rolled through into the hallway. Shinji grabbed the burning paper and pulled it off the brazier. The severed hand came with it, and he tossed it aside as he beat out the flames. Too late. Only half the paper was left. One of the three images. The courier had escaped with one, and the other was lost in the fire. No matter. There were ways to retrieve data even without the codes. The first step was to find the courier. Follow him! At Shinji's command, the two Yakuza sprinted out of the room into the hallway. Shinji knelt before the younger Vietnamese scientist.
Where's the courier going?
Shinji asked.
Where's he taking the data?
The young man summoned up all his courage and shook his head.
I can't tell you that.
Shinji rotated his thumb in front of the young man's face and smiled.
Oh, yes. I think you can.
Welcome to the Free City of Newark, said the sign over the customs entrance in 12 different languages. The 700 arriving passengers from the just-landed Beijing-Newark suborbital were all skeletons as they passed through the scanner, grinning skulls carried aloft on clacking bones. But wait, one of the skulls looked wrong.
Excuse me, sir.
Johnny's heart skipped a beat as he was stopped by the customs officer manning the scanner. Is there a problem? The officer showed Johnny his skeletal image. Inside the skull, a dark object rested, a robotic fetus in a cranial womb.
This implant.
Johnny smiled. It's all right. Government approved. Dyslexia prosthesis.
You have a permit, of course.
Of course. Johnny handed the officer a plastic card. The officer swiped the card through his machine and concentrated on the display. Johnny tried to ignore the vicious, pounding headache that had been getting steadily worse the entire 4 hours of the flight.
Sir, here's your card back. It checks out okay, but there is a problem.
Problem?
The scanner shows a seepage. Looks like your implant may be disgorging. Better get it checked.
Thanks. Gracias. Johnny hurried off down the corridor. It was a little girl's room. A pink and white powder puff of a room, hung with frilly curtains. The stuffed animals, the interactive dolls, everything in the room said joy, love, laughter, hope. Everything but the black-draped Shinto shrine in the center of the floor, and the man on the bed. He sat awkwardly, his expensively manicured hands resting on his knees. He was too big, too powerful. He looked out of place in the low, fluffy pink bed in his expensive Italian suit. But he was not thinking of himself or how he looked. He was thinking of his daughter, Mikio. Indeed, he was watching her. Mikio sat on the floor under a sun-flooded window in the corner, an 8-year-old girl with straight raven-black hair, wearing silk pajamas, a girl as delicate and beautiful as a ceremonial Japanese doll. Her voice rang clear and untroubled as she scolded her stuffed toy.
Now, Mop Mop, if you and Shirley can't play nicely, I'll have to separate you.
It was a happy scene, which made it all the more out of place that a tear was rolling down the hard face of the man on the bed. There was a knock at the door. The man picked up the remote that lay on the bed beside him and pointed it at the child in the corner. Suddenly, she was gone, along with her stuffed toy and the window that had shed its golden light upon her. The man set the remote back down on the bed.
Come in!
His secretary stuck her head in the door.
Sorry to disturb you, Mr. Takahashi, but...
I know, Mrs. Sutton. Shinji has arrived.
Takahashi's office was huge, as befit the head of North American operations for the Yakuza. He didn't offer his visitor a seat.
You look well enough, Shinji. Asia seems to agree with you.
He rested his gaze pointedly on the younger man's capped prosthetic thumb.
And I see you have found a way to turn your shame into an asset.
Before Shinji could respond, Takahashi continued.
I've seen the report from Tokyo. Pharmacombinat Industry of Zurich have engaged us to recover their missing data.
Shinji nodded.
Our operation in Beijing met with limited success. The Pharmacon traders are dead.
But the mnemonic courier escaped,
Takahashi said. Takahashi's tone was that of reproach.
With the data, he is coming here, to Newark, Shinji?
We have been given reason to believe so.
Why was I not informed of this fact at once?
I did not wish to disturb you in your grief, Takahashi-san, I assumed you are unavailable.
We are Yakuza, Shinji. I am always available.
What is the nature of the data we are to recover?
I have been charged with recovering the head of the mnemonic courier, cryogenically preserved.
Preserved?
Shinji nodded.
For the data, the defectors wiped the Pharmacom mainframe, then also destroyed the pirated CD-ROM. If we lose the courier, Pharmacom has lost the data forever.
Takahashi turned away. The situation was worse than he had thought. He turned back to face the younger Yakuza.
Newark is mine, Shinji. You were insolent when you trained here under me, and you are insolent still. You will report only to me, understand? If the mnemonic courier is in my territory, if you have not managed to lose him altogether, I will be responsible for the recovery of the data. I understand you managed to salvage at least one part of the courier's download code.
Only one of three images.
Better than nothing.
Takahashi held out his hand.
Give it to me.
Shinji pulled a singed, folded thermal paper from the inside pocket of his gray suit. Shinji handed the paper to Takahashi, executed the slightest of bows, and turned to leave. Takahashi waited until he was alone before unfolding the paper and spreading it onto his desk. It was charred on one side and sliced clean on the other. The image was from the Beijing Evening News of NAS rioters and police battling in the streets. He pressed a button on the vidphone on his desk, and his secretary's face appeared on the monitor.
Yes, sir, Mr. Takahashi?
Get me Carl Hoeing, Mrs. Sutton. The man they call Street Preacher. Church of Retransfiguration.
Some landscapes look bombed out, some are bombed out. Newark had the distinction of being both. The city had already been in ruins when the inner-city fighting heated up just after the turn of the century. In the succeeding decades, refugees from the fighting in New York and Philadelphia had moved in and taken over the shells of the buildings, patching together water, gas, and even bootleg electricity. Newark was a hellhole, or rather, a string of hellholes connected by shattered pavement and punctuated by skeletons of buildings. Johnny's head felt as if it were about to split. The howling of the taxi's long, dried-out shocks and the screams of its tortured springs reverberated agonizingly between his ears.
Hello?
Ralphie, it's me. Ralphie came up on the dusty, stained screen set in the back of the front seat.
That you, Johnny boy?
Somewhere in Newark, heading for the delivery.
You feeling any better?
Johnny could hear the beat of retro disco behind Ralphie's voice, which meant the agent was calling from his office in a booth at the drone. Worse. Much worse, Ralphie. I'm way overloaded, man. You wouldn't believe how much.
Johnny, you told me you got upgraded or I wouldn't have...
Yeah, whatever. I got the goods, Ralphie. I just want them out of my head. Fast. Did they get the download codes okay?
Don't worry, Johnny boy. They say they can extract easy with or without the codes. Delivery's confirmed. That means you get rid of the data.
Who is this they, Ralphie? What's going on, man? This is starting to feel like a blown deal to me. I don't even know who I'm dealing with, and I'm going to be completely exposed when I...
Johnny boy, has Ralphie ever let you down? I would have come with you, except I'm all tied up here at the office.
Johnny heard giggles and a faraway scream of hilarity or ecstasy.
All you have to do is get to the address I gave you. They'll take care of it from there. Look, just make the delivery, okay? Then come by the drone and we'll have a drink. Celebrate, Johnny boy.
Celebrate. Sure. Later. Johnny hung up. He took the thermal paper from his pocket and stared at the single image as the taxi threaded its way through the potholes and between the ruined buildings, deeper and deeper into the heart of darkness that was 21st century Newark. Bye-bye, Johnny boy. Ralphie hung up the phone and looked around the Naugahyde booth that served as his office. He turned to the two bodyguards who sat with him in the booth.
Too bad about Johnny. Good kid.
The two shrugged in perfect unison.
I never liked him, said one. Me neither, said the other.
Yo mama and Pretty didn't like anybody except each other, and they didn't like each other all that much. They had been man and woman once, though nobody except themselves could remember which had been the man and which the woman. Now they were both women. Ralphie's Amazon gladiator muscle. Yo mama was black, and Pretty was white. But they both had steroid spectacular biceps,
V2 rocket breasts and thighs twisted with muscle like bridge cables. There hadn't been enough meat left over for brains. Pretty and Yomama sat on either side of the little talent agent, flanking him in the booth. A man as well known and as little liked as Ralphie wouldn't last long in the drone without protective muscle. The strobe dance floor was filled, but it was hard to tell which of the patrons were swaying to the band, which were zoned out on wrecked drugs, and which were in the earlier, or later, stages of NAS. It might have been a scene from hell, if hell were a place people lined up to get into. At the bar, a young woman in a leather jacket was watching as Ralphie hung up on Johnny. She had been watching Ralphie all evening, all but ignoring the man standing next to her. He looked like a computer nerd on steroids, but there was a leaven of concern in the warm, brown eyes behind thick, horn-rimmed glasses.
About these episodes you've been having, Jane, I want to get you back to the shop for more tests. Hey, are you even listening to me?
No more tests, Spider. Jane was on her feet, walking away. A small, quick figure, in skin-tight black jeans and black leather, with short, spiked hair. As Jane walked towards Ralphie's booth, hands reached out to sample her as they would any attractive figure, male or female, who essayed through the meat market that was the drome's dance floor. Then the hands pulled back, without touching, for Jane seemed slightly dangerous. She walked like a fighter, with a menace and a strut that belied her size. She was just a few steps from Ralphie's booth when Pretty stood to ward off the half-pint intruder. But Jane caught the larger woman's shoulder, and using speed instead of strength, spun her off balance back down into the booth, where she hit the cushion with a woof. Jane's face was inches from Ralphie's, whose jaw had dropped open in surprise. Your hired muscle's aging on you, Ralphie. I could have done you. Time you hired somebody young. Somebody fast.
Why, you crazy little...
Yo mama hissed.
Street trash, bitch!
Pretty finished. They started to their feet as one, but Ralphie held them back with a backhanded gesture. He was intrigued.
Somebody like you?
Yeah.
Have we met...
I know you, Ralphie. You're the agent for all the best combat artists in town. Well, I'm the fastest thing going now that Spider's jacked my system.
You're fast, huh? Let's see. Hold out your hand.
Jane held out her hand, palm up and then palm down, showing off the thin, scarification lines almost like tattoos where Spider had gone in, regrouping and augmenting her tendons and nerves.
Well, just hold it steady. Right there.
Jane looked at him, a flash of alarm in her face. Ralphie smiled.
You can hold it steady, can't you?
Jane's hand was starting to tremble. Yomama and Pretty laughed in perfect unison.
You're damaged goods, baby,
said Yomama.
Yeah, like in another month or two, you'll be like her.
Pretty pointed to the bar, where a trembling victim of NAS was trying to raise her drink to her lips. It slopped down the front of her silver dress. Ralphie stared coldly at Jane.
Sorry, but I can't use you.
Jane backed away, restraining her rage.
I'll get a gig, Ralphie.
Then she turned and walked away into the harsh, strobed beat of the crowded dance floor. High above the dark tangle that was the ruins of Newark, in the steel bones of a building whose skin had long ago crumbled into red dust, a lone figure moved, climbing, dropping, hanging, and strolling as casually on the naked steel beams across yawning chasms as if he were sauntering along a sidewalk on the ground. Far more casually, in fact, for this high, abandoned upper realm was his turf, uncontested. The figure was dressed in a layered costume of what might appear to untrained eyes as rags, but it was all carefully chosen for color and dramatic effect, decorated with beads, totems, trinkets, and colored scraps like flags. Around his waist, on an ancient army web belt, he carried a collection of tools dedicated to the arts of breaking and entering, repair and salvage, recycling and refurbishing. Over his shoulder was slung a spring-loaded crossbow, a postmodern melding of firearm and slingshot, an ingenious adaptation of found technology of the sort that had given his loose clan of lost boys their name, Lotex. He stopped at the end of a swaying steel I-beam and looked down. Though his origins, his accomplishments, and even his last name were shrouded in obscurity, his face was well known. He was J-Bone, the acknowledged leader of the Lotex, the media rebel whose face and taunts were familiar around the world, wherever he and his crew decided to momentarily hijack the airwaves and insert their subversive message of autonomy, anarchy, and freedom. J-Bone was anywhere from 18 to 30. He lifted a monocular from his belt and watched a cab drive up to the old paint factory. Johnny walked toward the factory, where he had been told his contact was waiting. His head was pounding. With each slow, deliberate step, he breathed in calmness, breathed out panic, breathed in alertness, breathed out ego. By the time he reached the entrance, he was as ready as he could make himself. First, he stuck a small device to the door frame with two-sided tape. He armed it. The blinking of its red, ready light was echoed by the smaller light on his belt. He knocked. The door opened suddenly, as if whoever was inside had been waiting with one hand on the knob. "You're Johnny?" Johnny stepped back. "You're the contact?" He didn't like the looks of it. The man who had opened the door was a punk with spiked blue hair, wearing razor-toed cowboy boots and brick and asphalt blend camouflage. The kind of freelance street muscle the Yakuza often picked up for dirty assignments.
"Sure hope so. Come on in."
The room had a faintly medical look, with a folding table spread with white plastic under a bright light. At one end of the table was a tray filled with none-too-clean surgical tools, and a small cabinet with a handle on top, its glass door frosted with carbon dioxide mist. Johnny recognized it from his days looting organs from accident scenes and bootlegging them to donor banks. It was a cryo-carryall, a cryogenic organ transporter. Johnny took one step back, and from the shadows, another man took one step forward. At first, Johnny thought it was the Invisible Man from the old movie. The man's entire face was swathed in white bandages, except for two holes containing tiny eyes and a long slit for a mouth. Johnny recognized him, or at least his upper Montclair High School ring. It was the man he had thrown through the glass into the shower stall in Beijing, Shinji's right-hand man, Henson. He was holding a chrome saw. His smile appeared through the bandages like an open wound.
"The doctor will see you now."
Johnny's hand brushed against the sender unit on his belt, and the door exploded inward, sending the punk into Henson. Johnny dove through the shattered doorframe into the night. He hid himself behind a pile of 55-gallon oil drums and peered out. Henson was in the doorway, screwing a laser-sighted device into a 7.62 automatic with a folding stock. He stepped out of the door, but before he could fire, the top of his head collapsed inward with a dull, wet sound like a ripe watermelon cracking open. He pitched forward into the mud. Behind him, swinging a 2x4, Johnny saw a man whose face looked vaguely familiar. "Who are you, anyway?" The man pointed toward the horizon, beyond the ruined skyscrapers, to an ancient iron drawbridge, festooned with cables and crammed with shacks and walkways like a giant insect nest.
"I'm J-Bone. I run heaven. Up there."
Sometimes, when the sorrow threatened to overwhelm him, Takahashi found he could assuage it a little by showing the video he had made almost 5 years before, of Makio building a sandcastle on the beach. But what was this? He had watched this video many times, and never before had he seen the figure now approaching across the sand. The woman was fully dressed. She was somewhere in her 40s or early 50s, European, Asian, or a little of each. Startlingly beautiful, dressed in a simple but elegant linen and silk business suit, walking in high heels across the sand, leaving no tracks behind her. Takahashi hit off. He tried fast forward, he tried reverse. The woman's face filled the wall screen. She was wearing striking yin and yang earrings. The woman looked at him as if she could see him.
"How sad, the loss of a child."
"Who are you? What are you?"
"I understand your loss. I have also experienced, in my own way, the loss of a child."
"You are an illusion. You are a hallucination."
"Of course, an illusion, like life itself. But let us hallucinate together, Takahashi. There is something I want to share with you. As an executive and as a parent, something you will understand."
"No! Get out of here! Leave me alone!"
"I was like you, Takahashi. I was you. Rigid, powerful. My will flashing like lightning between all the world's megacities. My name a cold wind in the corridors of power."
"You are sent by my enemies!"
The woman shook her head.
Say rather that I am sent by conscience, in the name of memory.
Memory?
Where I am, Takahashi, there is only memory. All is memory. Memory and the play of conscience. An endless reckoning of the score.
Hell?
The woman laughed.
You are in your own hell, Takahashi. Your purpose is lost. At the very center of all your power, there is only an emptiness. A hollowness carved in the shape of an absent child.
Suddenly she was gone. Makio was back, or Makio's image, playing on the beach. The men's room was empty. Ralphie stationed himself in front of the urinal, unzipped his pants, and suddenly he was grabbed from behind in a hammerlock. They were waiting for me, Ralphie. Two of them. Yakuza. But you knew that. You set me up, didn't you? Friend.
Johnny, it's not my fault. There's been a screw-up, but it's not my... Ow, man, you're hurting me.
I mean to hurt you. I'm gonna do worse than hurt you, Ralphie. Your ass is dead if you don't figure out a way to get this batch of product out of my head before... Thwack! Ralphie felt the grip relax as the voice went silent. He pulled free and turned, and saw Yo Mama standing over Johnny's crumpled body. She was holding a high-heeled pump in her hand. Ralphie groaned. Not on the head. Tell me you didn't hit him on the head. Ralphie bent down and checked Johnny's scalp. No blood, and he was still breathing. Now let's get him into the back room, okay? Yo Mama looked at Johnny as easily as if he had been a rag doll. Ralphie followed her out of the men's room, picking up Pretty on the way. Jane watched as Yo Mama carried Johnny into the back room, Ralphie and Pretty following. Then a gray-suited man got up from a nearby table and went into the back room too, closing the door behind them. He didn't bother to hide the Chinese-made Shensei broom handle 45 in his belt. Ralphie's head was hovering over Johnny like a bad planet.
Ralphie, what did they upload? The goddamn Library of Congress? My head feels like it's gonna explode!
Ralphie almost managed to look embarrassed.
Your friend here tells me he can take care of that, Johnny.
Another face joined Ralphie's. It was Shinji. He was holding a Makita saber saw. Johnny tried to sit up, but he was held down by a leather strap around his arms and upper body. His legs were free and he kicked them futilely.
Ralphie, you lying sack of shit! What am I supposed to do, Johnny? Argue with the Yakuza?
He steps aside so that Yo Mama could set what she was carrying onto the table beside Johnny's head. Craning his neck to look around, Johnny saw a cryo-carry-all portable organ freezer. Exactly the size of his head.
Oh, shit! Can we talk about this?
Talk?
You didn't bother talking to Henson.
I have one image of the access code. You have the other two parts.
Look, let's download. I'll give you the data. Glad to get rid of it. Look, everybody'll be happy.
Shinji tried the saw.
You don't understand. We only have one, and our clients don't just want the data anyway. They want everything it's ever been stored in.
Yeah, but...
That way, there's less danger of information decay, and they won't have to worry about somebody going in later with an unraced nanobot or memory restorer. These days, you see, dead men can tell tales.
There's gotta be a way to work this out.
There is.
Shinji took a small blue rubber ball out of his pocket and jammed it into Johnny's mouth. He opened the little door on the cryo carry-all. The air was icy cold on Johnny's face.
A new and final kind of cool. From where Jane was perched, across two of the lightweight alumi-steel supports holding the cheap ceiling vent into place, it looked like an opening scene on her favorite real-life TV show, Operating Room. Except that the patient was wide awake, rolling his head from one side to another in silent panic. He had a blue rubber ball in his mouth. Jane didn't bother to think. Snap decisions were her forte. She drew her knees to her chest and dropped straight down into the vent, which gave way smoothly, giving her time to grab the T-frame for a swing and get her boots pointed dead center at the temple of the Yakuza with the ponytail and the whining saw.
What the fuck?
Ralphie saw Shinji go down hard.
Pretty and Yomama both dived for the intruder, who had landed on her feet and was already spinning, drop-kicking Pretty backward into the door, where she hit with a sickening crack and slid to the floor. Yomama pulled a pearl-handled box cutter from the bosom of her low-cut dress. Jane pulled out her own weapon, concealed in her belt, a telescoping car antenna with a razor-sharp steel fang welded to the end. The blade bobbed like a fly rod over Yomama's face, centimeters from her heavily mascaraed eyes. Yomama was unimpressed. She held her box cutter at Johnny's jugular.
I'll slit his fucking throat, bitch!
So, the Yakuza was gonna cut his head off. Ralphie, mustering all his courage, stepped between the two women.
Jane, what say we pay you for a night's work and you just walk away, okay?
Jane folded the antenna.
$20,000.
Johnny groaned. He finally managed to spit out the blue ball.
I'll give you $50,000.
Don't listen to him, Jane. He's a dead man.
Johnny lashed out sideways with his foot and caught Ralphie precisely between the legs. Ralphie doubled over in agony, and as he did, Yomama dove for Jane with the box cutter. Jane flicked the antenna back out, then up, neatly severing three of the five major tendons in Yomama's wrist. Yomama howled in pain and rage, dropping the box cutter. Jane caught it before it hit the floor and sliced through the strap that bound Johnny's arms. Meanwhile, Shinji was on his knees, unscrewing the cap on his thumb. Johnny rolled off the table, hitting hands first, and heaved upward with his feet. The table flew across the room, catching Shinji in the side. Jane stepped to Johnny's side and they backed towards the door. One step, two. Johnny opened the door with one hand and let Jane through, then slipped through behind him. Just as he was slamming the door behind him, he heard the high singing sound of Shinji's filament cutting past his head. He ducked and fled, following Jane into the crowded dance floor. The building had once housed a movie theater, a Sony Super 12-plex. Then it had fallen into decline and had become a flea market. Then it had fallen still further. It had become a church. Above the marquee, a neon sign proudly announced, Church of the Retransfiguration. Inside the double doors of the sanctuary, the urine and Pepsi-stained seats were filled with mostly poor, mostly older men and women. Some of them were shivering, still wet from the storm outside that had brought them in to seek shelter. There was a movie screen at the front of the sanctuary. On it was projected an image of the crucifixion, inverted. Under the image on the screen, on the low, wide stage, a tall man with long white hair, wearing a burgundy robe, paced back and forth, clutching an inverted crucifix into which he chanted as if it were a microphone.
Some teach that these are the final days, but we have seen a new way, a new light. In this plague time, our goal is the image of the retransfiguration. Amen,
muttered the few in the crowd who were paying attention. The preacher let his purple robe fall open. Under it, he was naked except for silver-tipped cowboy boots and gold bikini briefs. His massive torso was scarred with the marks of implant surgery.
I stand before you naked in the house of God, whole and strong.
The preacher noticed the Yakuza operative entering the back door carrying an unfamiliar box and a familiar vidphone unit.
But now, I sense a need for meditation, brothers and sisters. Leave me now. The sermon is ended.
The Yakuza driver placed the cryo carryall and the vidphone on the floor beside him. An image appeared on the vidphone screen. It was Takahashi.
Good evening, Kar. I require your services on a rather urgent matter.
You wish someone brought to Jesus?
The preacher flicked a button on the inverted cross he wore around his neck. A blade snicked out as if it were transformed into a switchblade. Takahashi shook his head.
Not exactly. The little box on the floor beside you, Carl, is a cryo unit. An organ freezer. I want his head brought to me in it. Intact. Undamaged.
The preacher smiled.
And who is this lost soul? This sinner unrepentant?
A mnemonic courier carries bootleg data in his brain. Goes by the name of Johnny. Last seen at a club called The Drome.
The Drome. I know it well. By reputation, of course. The very pit of Satan.
I'm prepared to triple your usual fee, Carl, if you deliver his head to me within 24 hours.
The preacher smiled and closed his eyes in what might have seemed to the uninitiated to be prayer. Rats. Giant water bugs. Even a feral cat or two. Jane's light caught myriad scurrying shapes as she led the way through the abandoned subway tunnel. As they walked along, Johnny told Jane his story. He was wincing, clutching his head, stumbling along, and finally he collapsed onto the wet cinders. Jane shone the flashlight onto his face. His pupils were tiny, his eyes almost white. A thin trickle of blood ran from one nostril. Jane clicked off her light. Stay put, okay? Johnny was having a dream. In the dream, Johnny was crossing a huge room, and there was a desk, and it was a big desk. And at the desk was a woman, and she was very pretty. He knew it was his mother, because he couldn't see her face. Johnny! Hey! What's the matter? Johnny studied the face of the woman sitting beside him in the darkness. Then he sat up with a sudden cry.
I can't believe it. You let me sleep. I'm a dead man, and soon, if I don't get this stuff out of my head.
Jane helped him up, and they trudged along the old subway track, trying not to notice the shrill squeals and scurrying underfoot. Jane spoke. How did they get that stuff into your head? Johnny pointed toward the small jack behind his ear.
Implant. I had to dump a lot of long-term memory to become a courier.
Like what?
My childhood.
All of it?
You can't even remember your parents?
Johnny shook his head.
So, what do you think about
when you're alone?
Right now, I think about where I can go to log on to the net.
The net? What for?
You can dump the data that way?
No, but I can use the net to find out where they fax the download codes. I have one image, the Yakuza have one, maybe two. Maybe all three got faxed through and I can get a hold of them somehow. It's a long shot, but it's better than no shot, so let's get moving. Johnny and Jane broke into a computer repair shop. Johnny began pulling parts off the shelves, muttering to himself. Jane sat back and watched as he pulled together the parts and assembled them. The Synerlogic 16 looked like an antique laptop. She felt almost happy as she watched him boot the machine, then pull gloves on and goggles down over his eyes. Whatever happened now was all up to him. The headache went away in cyberspace. It was like flying. The grid rolled away under him as he swung through it, arms extended just for the thrill of it. Too bad you had to have a body, Johnny thought. Be great just to stay here all the time where there's no pain, no want, no hunger. But forget all that. There was work to do. Shapes appeared in the near distance, and Johnny swooped between them. Triangles, heloids, octagrams. Nothing looked familiar, but he cruised on ahead looking for landmarks. There, the inverted Y of the Yakuza West Coast database loomed ahead. Johnny pushed on, bound for Virtual North. He was getting his bearings again, finding the instinctual sense of direction that had made him one of the best of the cowboys when he had made this kind of run two, even three times a month. He reneaked past a few lighted edulands, too insignificant to fool with. He flew low, using them to navigate, since he knew they would be aligned in the general direction of Jersey Bell. He felt the slight ping of a Whois ID check. Odd. He flew on. He didn't notice that one of the lands was connected by a glowing ribbon of virtual light to an inverted pyramid on the horizon, the icon of the Yakuza's intelligence database. Johnny's gloved hands moved in front of him as if manipulating invisible objects. Then they stopped.
Got it. The fax went to an all-night coffee shop. A fucking will call. For a Dr. Allcom. Sounds like a phony name.
Let's go, Johnny, okay?
this place is spooking me. Gotta try one other thing. Guy called Strike.
Johnny dropped, searching for the pyramid of the Sprint Communications megatrust that linked Toronto and Detroit with the sprawl. He runs a BBS somewhere in this sector. Toronto, I think. Johnny reneged down the ice-encrusted pyramid of the sprawl net until he saw a light that looked familiar. He veronica'd around it once, then took a chance and dove. Just like Strike, a keyhole. Johnny gophered in. Strike's smiley sun image began to appear.
Johnny, get off my board, man. You're too hot. You're a hit waiting to happen.
What's the word in the net, Strike?
Look, all I know is that you've got a head full of Pharmacom data, and the Yakuza wants you bad.
Pharmacom? Strike's image was about to answer, when suddenly it began to morph. What's this new trick, Johnny wondered. Must be the low-tex. Strike's smiley face morphed into the face of a woman. A woman who was strange and yet somehow totally familiar. She was in her 50s, well-dressed, European, with yin and yang earrings. Something about her felt real. Too real.
Johnny?
He stopped. How do you know my name? She morphed into a full figure and extended what resolved itself into a hand. How do you know my name? But instead of answering, the woman disappeared. The universe disappeared.
Move!
Jane ripped the goggles off Johnny and threw them across the room. She pulled the Jaff out of the Synologic 16, leaving the core dangling from Johnny's head. Johnny sat watching her, dazed.
Come on!
There was the sound of breaking glass. Johnny turned and saw the front door shatter inward. A hand reached in, turned the knob.
How? Who?
Johnny tore off his gloves, still dazed. Jane grabbed his collar and yanked him out of his seat.
Yakuza!
She pushed him toward the back door. Johnny unbolted the door and was about to step out into the alley when he saw a carton on the shelf over his head. Infobond 3000, a handy hacker's tool. Johnny grabbed the box and pulled it down just as Jane flew past him into the alley. You can judge the health of a city by its malls. Newark's were dark, dingy, poorly ventilated, crime-ridden, trash-encrusted, rat-infested and smelly, echoing with unsavory elevator rock and buzzing with going-bad neon. In a word, dying. The perfect place for two people on the run. It was early morning now. Johnny and Jane sat at a picnic table outside a Java and pizza kiosk, plotting their next move. Since the Yakuza had found them by scanning the net, Johnny knew that his phone, bank, and med cards were useless. But Jane had a phone card. Johnny slipped it into the clip and hacked into security at Pharmacom Industries' Newark branch.
I want your data out of my head. I've got one image of the download code. Can you get the other two?
The security man nodded.
Sure, no problem.
Great. I'll be there in 40 minutes.
As he disconnected, Jane exploded.
You're crazy! They're lying through their teeth. Pharmacom can't get the codes. They'll chop your head off.
Listen, Jane, if you don't want to come with me, fine. If it works out, I'll still get you the 50 thou I owe you. If it doesn't work out, you're dead.
I'm dead anyway if I don't get this shit out of my head.
Johnny turned on his heel and walked off. She raised a trembling hand and called out after him.
Hey, Johnny, listen. This guy, Spider, he used to be like a doctor, you know? He could, like fix you, maybe. Your head.
Johnny stopped. There was something about the sound of her voice. He turned. Jane was leaning over, her knees knocking as if she had lost control of her legs.
Hey, what's with you?
She pitched forward. He was already running toward her, and he managed to catch her before she hit the ground.
Jesus, you're sick. You strung out or what?
I'm not. No.
Then Johnny knew. You've got NAS. Jane's eyes rolled back in her head.
Spider, he's got a drug that helps me. Placed not far from here. Dead end of...
I can't deal with this now, Jane. Understand? I've got to go to Pharmacom.
Jane nodded, clenching her teeth.
Whatever it is, you're sidelined till after I make this meeting, right?
Comprende?
Capiche?
No answer.
Hey, Jane! Can you hear me?
Jane's eyes were closed. She was starting to tremble faster and faster, more and more violently.
Shit!
Johnny picked her up in his arms and headed for the exit. Jane managed to give the cabbie instructions to Spider's rough, single-story shed. It appeared to be constructed from scraps of billboards, fiberglass sheets, and old highway signs. Johnny half-carried, half-walked Jane inside. The single room was a garage with a dirt floor. A step van with a spider image painted on its side was parked against the far wall. At the center of the garage was a table set up on concrete blocks. The table was stainless steel, an operating room table. To Johnny, the place looked like a cross between an abortion clinic and a transmission shop. Spider moved fast. He gave Jane a muscle relaxant. Johnny looked at her sleeping face.
Hey, Spider. It's NAS, right?
Yeah. Nerve attenuation syndrome. Like half the people walking around this goddamn town.
He looked at Johnny, his eyes narrowing with suspicion and jealousy.
And who are you, anyway? You a client or a boyfriend?
Name's Johnny.
Johnny, who the hell?
Just Johnny.
Understand one thing, just Johnny. Okay?
What's that?
It wasn't my work that got Jane fucked up this way. I do augmentations and amplifications, and my work is clean. Besides, you don't get NAS from aug and amp jobs. That's just a myth.
So what does cause it? Spider smiled wryly.
Cause it? The world causes it.
He walked from the operating table across the room to a cluttered workbench and gestured toward a floppy drive, a gutted answering machine, a dusty fax, a telephone.
This causes it. This causes it. This causes it.
He grabbed Johnny by the shoulders.
You cause it. I cause it. NAS is about information overload, man. All the electronics around you poisoning the airwaves. Technological fucking civilization. But we still have all this shit because we can't live without it.
Spider looked at Johnny intently.
You got it too, just Johnny, huh?
Me? NAS? No. Something else.
You've had brain work, right?
You might say that. Silicone implants. Neural overplays. Memory augmentation.
And it's gone bad? What's the deal, just Johnny?
Johnny looked Spider up and down, a look somewhere between the look one gives a god and a demon. A last hope look. I got this problem. Up here. Maybe you can help me. While Jane slept peacefully, Spider looked at Johnny's head with his brain scan monitor. He whistled at the first image.
Man, they did some serious shoehorning to get that stuff in.
Spider turned the chair so that Johnny could see the X-ray image of his head on the monitor. All around the hardwire implant, there were dark streaks, spreading tendrils penetrating deeper and deeper into the gray.
Must hurt like hell. With this kind of seepage, even if I can work a downfall, I'm not sure the product will be coherent.
Fuck the product. I just want it out.
Allcom. That's who's going to pick up the download code. Dr. Allcom. Ever hear of a Dr. Allcom? Spider shrugged.
Maybe.
Johnny caught something in Spider's voice.
You know who it is, don't you? Where is he? Who is he? Just tell me where to go.
Okay, just Johnny. Better than that, I'll drive you.
Spider maneuvered the step van out of the garage and into the night. He dropped into drive and turned onto the street, just as a large figure under a gleaming shock of white hair, with silver toes on muddy boots and a gleaming knife in hand, came hurtling around the corner of the shed. Jane fell back into Johnny's arms as the step van spun its wheels and then charged forward. The figure Spider now recognized as Street Preacher angled across the muddy lot, seeking to cut off the step van before it started down the hill. Spider fishtailed. The engine screamed. Street Preacher leaped for the open side door, his knife in his teeth. Spider ducked, then saw the windshield shatter as Street Preacher hit it with his chin. Street Preacher bounced off the shattered glass and rolled into the mud as Spider's step van careened like a runaway stagecoach down the hill. Johnny stared out the back window.
What the fuck was that?
Spider shook his head.
You don't want to know.
Takahashi had used the most sophisticated computer equipment at the Yakuza's disposal to finally track down the middle-aged woman wearing yin-yang earrings. Now he knew why the search had been so difficult, why it had taken so long to come up with a positive identification. He had mistakenly, foolishly, naively instructed the program to search among the living. Now he listened to the computer report.
Anna Kalman, late CEO of the multinational pharma combinat industry Zero. Born 1 August 1965, died 3 September 2015. She was scanned in and imprinted to Pharmacom's neural net installation in Zurich prior to the onset of morbidity. Her neural net persona has Swiss citizenship under the artificial intelligence law of 2006. She advises the current board from...
Takahashi clicked off the monitor.
A ghost. She's a ghost.
Newark's Union Station was once considered one of the architectural wonders of the Northeast. That was a long time ago. The long, curved driveway once used for cabs and limousines was now empty, except for an ambulance or two. Spider's step van screeched to a halt in front of the station's big revolving door. Jane and Johnny followed Spider inside. The station was filled with sounds of pain and death. The sick and the dying were lying on old wooden waiting room benches, on stretchers on the floor, on beds against the cold marble walls. The few erect moving figures were nurses and orderlies in stained, ragged uniforms, stooped with fatigue, who hurried from one hopeless scene to the next. Johnny had never seen such suffering. He felt something brush against his hand. It was Jane's hand. He took it and held it. And together, they stared into the chaos. Meanwhile, Spider was busy. He took a filthy white smock off a hook and put it on over his coveralls.
Spider, thank God you're here!
A young black nurse shoved a clipboard into his hand. Spider studied it and shook his head.
This many? Just since last night?
The nurse nodded. Johnny spoke.
What's going on here, Spider? NAS. We're the only treatment center around, since the government gave up.
He pointed around the room at the nurses and orderlies hurrying around. Judging by their jerky movements, some of them seemed to be suffering from the disease themselves.
All volunteers.
Is this where we find Dr. Alcom? Spider laughed wryly.
Dr. Alcom is the name we page in hospitals if we've got a major problem and don't want to spook the civilians. Dr. Alcom to Ward 7... That sort of thing. We all drop everything and haul ass over to Ward so no wherever. It means we need all the help we can get fast.
Johnny shook his head.
But I saw it on the fax buffer. It was the pickup for the download code.
I know. Spider ducked under a flap into a shed partitioned off with plywood and canvas from the main area of the terminal. Johnny followed, with Jane right behind him.
What do you mean, you know?
Spider switched on a light. The shed was an improvised operating room.
I know, because the fax was for us.
What?
Who's us? The NAS Underground. People who try to keep this place going. People like me. Get on the table here.
Johnny hesitated. Spider was throwing switches on an electronic console. A light gleamed on a monitor set against a wall.
Look just, Johnny. You want that stuff out, right?
Johnny reluctantly lay down. Spider pulled a video scanner on a segmented extension down from the wall. He placed it over the top of Johnny's head, then frowned.
No access code.
Except for one image out of three. I have it right here in my pocket. Johnny started to sit up, but Spider stopped him with a touch on the shoulder.
It won't help. What did they use, random images?
Yeah, from the TV.
Shit.
Does that mean you can't get the data out?
Oh, I can get it out.
Spider was washing his hands with green soap. Surgical soap. Johnny didn't like the look of it. He sat up.
How?
Spider dried his hands on a bloody towel.
With a general anesthetic, a cranial drill, and a pair of forceps.
Johnny swung his feet off the table.
You're joking, right?
Spider shook his head.
No joke.
Jane took a quick step forward.
He'll die!
It's gonna kill him anyway, and soon.
Spider turned to Johnny.
I take it out, and you'll survive. You'll lose some fine motor skills. You might be able to remember anything for longer than 3 minutes. But you'll survive. Fuck that, and fuck you!
He stood up, but Spider pushed him back onto the operating table.
Let me tell you something, just Johnny. Let's start with what you got inside there.
He tapped Johnny's head, and Johnny winced.
Let's start with what it's worth to the world. What you're carrying is the cure to NAS.
Johnny studied Spider's face, looking for signs he was being bullshitted. He didn't find any.
You're telling me that what's in my head is Pharmacom's complete R&D on the cure for nerve attenuation syndrome, plus the records of the field trials to prove it works. And it works like a motherfucker.
Jane's fluttering hand rose and touched her cheek in surprise and hope.
You mean, like, a real cure? A real cure. They could have you straightened out in 3 weeks, Janie. You and everybody else.
Johnny frowned.
But wait a minute. How could that be? The Yakuza are trying to cut off my fucking head. They're working for Pharmacom. They want your head so they can take it back to Saigon and run it under a quantum interference detector and reconstruct the data. Don't you get it? I'm just a courier. I try not to get it. Well, you better start understanding. The data was stolen by the men who hired you, the two Vietnamese. They had been Pharmacom scientists, but I guess they had an attack of conscience. They saw how important the cure was, and they wanted to share it with the world. Pharmacom wants to get it back so they can hold it back, so they can piece it out, sell it off slowly, expensively, make all this suffering pay off for them.
Spider put his hand on Johnny's arm.
The cure can save millions of lives.
Johnny shook his arm free.
What does it matter to me if I'm dead?
He tried not to look at Jane. Spider shrugged.
You're dead anyway if we don't get it out. If you leave it in your head, the cure is lost. Already the seepage is corrupting the data. If we don't act soon, why should I trust you?
Johnny turned to Jane.
Why should I trust either of you?
As if in answer to his question, a wheeled gurney suddenly burst through the canvas flap into the shed. The young black nurse Johnny had seen before lay on the gurney. She was wearing a bright red apron of blood over her whites, her mouth wide open in a silent scream. Her throat had been cut.
Praise the Lord!
Street preacher came through the flap right behind her, his hands outstretched as if he wanted to embrace the entire world.
Praise be! The cure is love! Behold your savior!
Jane reached into her shoulder bag and stepped in front of Johnny. Spider saw what she was doing and stepped between her and the street preacher.
Run for it!
Street preacher reached out and picked up Spider by the neck, tossing him aside as easily as if he were a rag doll. Johnny rolled off the table backwards and grabbed a scalpel from a tray against the wall. He threw it at street preacher, who ducked. Jane pulled two throwing spikes from her shoulder bag. The first one missed. The second one went into street preacher's shoulder. Deep. Street preacher looked down, surprised, and plucked it from his shoulder. Grinning, he aimed it at her and pulled back to throw. Spider tackled him from the side.
Run, damn it!
Johnny pulled Jane toward him, across the operating table. There was a crack in the plywood wall behind him, large enough for them to squeeze through one at a time. Spider yelled after them.
Jones, Janie! Get him to Jones!
He reached into his pants pocket and grabbed something and threw it. It jingled when Jane caught it. It was the keys to the step van. As they fled down the corridor, Jane heard what she didn't want to hear. Spider's death scream. They roared off through the deserted streets of what had been Newark's downtown.
Who's this Jones?
Jane seemed evasive.
Friend of J-Bone's. Hangs with the low-techs, sort of. That's where we're going?
She nodded.
Heaven, out in the Ratlands. Hey, Jane, is there a vid phone in this rig?
She nodded again.
Try the glove compartment, and under the seat.
Once he had put the vid phone together, he plugged into the Infobot 3000 and called up the special RR routing he had coded into the memory the first time he had hacked through to Pharmacom's central security. Johnny was a little surprised to see a different security man pick up the vid phone.
Who the hell are you?
Don't worry about that. I know who you are.
That's what counts. What happened?
Couldn't make the meeting. Unavoidable system errors. But I'm still up for it, are you?
Certainly.
This time, the place is the low-tech hideout called Heaven. A Passaic bridge somewhere out in...
I know where it is. Ratlands.
Good. I have one piece of the code. You can still get the other two, right?
I'll be there. I'll bring it.
Johnny switched off the vidphone before the call could be ID'd. As he did so, Jane turned to him, her eyes blazing. Are you crazy? Spider sacrificed himself to save you, and now you're betraying him? Betraying all of us? Not if I can... Chill. In the first place, it wasn't me he died to save. It was the data, and you. And in the second place, he lied. I have a plan. The ponytailed security man stared straight ahead as if brain dead. Indeed, he was brain dead. His mouth sagged, his forehead bulged grotesquely as Takahashi scratched his own jaw thoughtfully with the video puppet glove.
The courier has one image. If he gets hold of the other two, he can download the data on his own. Then his head will be worthless, like my honor.
Cold horror fell over him at the thought. Takahashi's private executive secretary, Mrs. Sutton, kept a studio apartment only an elevator's ride away from her boss's office. So it was a simple enough matter for him to ring her to make the arrangements for his sudden departure, even at 4 a.m. She was at his office in 5 minutes. Takahashi was packing.
Order me a helicopter, and get me a cryo unit. One of the portable ones. What are they called?
Cryo carryall. Mrs. Sutton made the calls on the vidphone, and in no time at all, the cryo carryall had arrived, and the muted whump, whump, whump of the helicopter could be heard on the roof. As soon as she was certain that the helicopter had taken off, Mrs. Sutton punched a number into the vidphone, and a face came up on the monitor. It was Shinji.
Yes!
He's on his way. The Passaic Bridge was built to complete an access highway to the tunnels of New York. It was a drawbridge, raised to allow ships to pass through the Great Marsh of the Meadowlands. First, the shipping had gone. Then the tunnels to New York had gone, destroyed by Plastique. Then, with the end of cheap oil, the truck and auto traffic had gone. Then the Meadowlands were gone, filled in with garbage and rubble. They became the Ratlands. Finally, the river itself was gone, moving east on a new channel, leaving the bridge stranded, a flaking, rusting, cantilevered iron monster. Then the Lotex came and created Heaven. From below, Heaven looked like a hornet's nest, an organic and natural accretion with cargo containers, subway cars, small boats, salvaged aircraft and mobile homes lashed and pinned to the girders of the Passaic Bridge, connected by dizzying walkways of rope and plank, all swaying and creaking in the breezes that still blew across the half-remembered marsh. Heaven was a combination outlaw city and fortress, a modern-day faux castle moated by thin air and ruled by one man who was himself only a few years away from being a boy, J-Bone. Below Heaven, in the dry landfill of the Ratlands, 6 people got out of a limousine. They wore black jumpsuits, Italian rock-climbing shoes, and web belts hung with matte black null-reflectant climbing gear. 2 of the 6 were women. 1 of the 4 men was Shinji. He instructed 2 of the Yakuza to stay put and left them a Russian-made Thermidor, shoulder-mounted, heat-seeking, anti-aircraft, recoilless missile launcher.
Cover the car and cover us from below. The Thermidor gets used only if we require a diversion or if you come under attack.
There are no handrails in Heaven. J-Bone led Johnny and Jane from level to level, post to beam, up concrete stairs and down steel ladders with perforated rungs, in hoop ladderways and out through meshed shafts, under collapsed walkways and over narrow plankways rattling above a dizzying abyss of thin, dark air. When they came to one gangway, a shallow arch of illegal plastic milk cartons held together by particle physics and phone cord, Johnny could see the gleam of oily water far below.
He reached for the non-existent handrail with one hand, for Jane's hand with the other. That part felt just right. Her hand and his, the rightness of it alarmed him, and he wondered, when did this happen? J-Bone pointed.
True here!
Ahead, up a short ladder, was a deck leading to a larger-than-usual space, the gutted fuselage of a C-144, still blackened from a long-ago fire, winched against the bottom of the bridge with cables, wedged solid with old tires. Through a tiny row of windows, Johnny could see the familiar blue light of TV monitors, blue and rose, the colors of cyberspace, or at least, of those windows in this world that peer into it. In the doorway, J-Bone turned back.
Come on in!
He didn't have to insist. Johnny almost floated into the room, Jane right behind him. With the cool colors, the soft electronic buzz, Johnny felt almost as if he were heading home, wherever the hell that was. J-Bone swept his arms, including the entire space and the low-techs tending it.
We call this Times Square. Spider's people? They give us information, and we out it.
Out it?
Wideband, global, give it away. Jones hacks for us, breaks us into all the Comsat nets, fiber optic webs, sneaky-like, so nobody can flame us or keep us out.
The last thing Johnny expected to see was a 12-foot diameter blue plastic swimming pool, 4.5 feet deep, a freestanding backyard model set against the far wall. Cables led into the pool from the main control console, from the bank of monitors, from the power terminals on the floor, and from the dish antenna above the ceiling on the roof. Beside the pool, on segmented hydraulic stocks, were two arrays of cone-shaped scanners stamped U.S. Navy. There was a clear glass panel in the front of the pool, and the glow through the water showed that there were instruments under the water, as well as a bank of brightly lighted buttons, and there was something else in the pool. Something moving. Something big. Johnny took a step forward.
A fish?
J-Bone grimaced, a play frown.
Yo, man, watch that. Jones is a friend of mine. He's hardwired, like you, Johnny.
More than wired, Johnny saw, as the dolphin surfaced sluggishly, his grace nearly lost under the crusted ferroplastic articulated armor gleaming dully along his side. Faded stencils read, U.S. Navy. Twin bulges on either side of the dolphin's skull gave him the clumsy look of an AWACS spy plane. J-Bone tapped the Navy scanners.
Jones is a cyborg. Surplus from the last war. And this was Spider's best bet?
Johnny was amazed, then dismayed, then finally, angry.
One thing Spider wasn't was a fool. Jones is our main hacker here. He's connected to the satellite dish up top, logs onto the commsats, juggles the frequencies. He makes it all work out. Might say he's the low-tech CPU, and he's a multitasking motherfucker, let me tell you. Yeah, but hacking's just a sideline for Jones. See, Spider knew that Jones is really designed to work with squids, sucking the codes out of enemy subs.
Squids?
Superconducting quantum interference detectors. See those bulging implants where his eyebrows ought to be? Well, let me tell you something. He is hardwired to suck out software, capture the codes out of enemy subs. Jones is a code breaker, baby. Infrasound scans right through the hull.
You're saying he can read this chip of mine? Figure out the download code? J-Bone shrugged.
Yo, man, even the primitive squids could measure a magnetic field a millionth the strength of a geomantic force. It's like pulling a whisper out of a cheering stadium.
And according to Spider, Jones is a late model. Jones was thrashing, and the cheeps and chirps were getting louder, almost forming an approximation of intelligent sound. In fact, J-Bone seemed to understand them.
Okay, sailor. Jane, can you take care of Jones?
Sure. Jane opened a drawer and rummaged through it until she found a syringe. Holding it in her fist, she leaned over the pool. Jones surfaced, heaving half of his armored bulk over the edge of the pool, Instinctively, Johnny jumped back in alarm, afraid the cheap blue plastic pool would crack. Jane stabbed Jones overhand with the syringe, striking between two of its armor plates. Johnny could have sworn Jones was smiling as he slid back into the water.
What the hell was that?
Jane handed Johnny the empty syringe.
What do you think?
Johnny held it up to the light.
Heroin?
J-Bone nodded.
He's a junkie. We keep him supplied. With smack. But how does a cybernetic dolphin get hooked on smack?
J-Bone seemed surprised at Johnny's naivete.
Yo, man, the war. The Navy had him all hooked. How else you get him to work for you? Now get in the chair if you want us to unlock these codes. Then we can dig this crap out of your head. This is bullshit.
Jane took his hand.
Try, Johnny. What choice do you have? What choice do any of us have?
Johnny sat in the chair.
J-Bone held out his hand. Now you give me what you got off the download code. Okay, brother?
Johnny reached into his pocket and pulled out the torn paper and handed it to J-Bone. It was the Japanese cartoon character.
Captain Kitano. Okay, roll 'em, boys.
In the darkness under the bridge, the ropes hung down like thick tendrils, heavy with black, poisonous fruit. Motoring up, Shinji and his Yakuza assault team were shapes barely distinguishable from the night. Nearby, Street Preacher watched. He loved competition. He smiled. Steel teeth gleamed. Johnny watched as one of the low-techs fed the image of the Japanimation superhero into a scanner. The superhero image appeared on one of the monitors over the control console. The two others at either side were undifferentiated snow. J-Bone nodded.
Now, if Jonesy can retrieve the other two images, we'll have the code.
Jane reached over and squeezed Johnny's hand. He squeezed back.
Let's go then. Let's do it.
J-Bone shook his head.
Not yet, brother. First you and I, we gotta make a deal.
Johnny looked over warily.
Now what? I know what's in your head. Jane here told me. We all know. And if Jones gets it out, the world knows.
What do you mean?
Yo, man, the cure for NAS. We broadcast it. Put it on the net, right across the platter. Free. Baby, we give it away.
Johnny considered this concept. He realized he had never given anything away before. He lived in a world in which everything, including his very memory, had always been for sale. A slow grin spread across his face.
Listen, if you can get it out, be my guest. Knock yourself out. Give it away.
Jane grinned and squeezed Johnny's hand again. Without thinking, Johnny drew Jane close and kissed her. Jane's eyes widened with surprise ever so slightly, then closed as she kissed him back, long and slow and deep. The Daihatsu 444 beat its way over the Ratlands. The pilot didn't like flying so low. He didn't like flying at night without lights, and he didn't like the man sitting next to him. His passenger was one of the Yakuza big boys, polite but cold. The pilot felt a hand on his arm. Takahashi was pointing up ahead to where a former drawbridge, a dark and deconstructed pile of rubble, rose from the Ratlands into the night sky.
There!
Jane watched as Johnny grew rigid, leaning back in his chair. In the pool, Jones was trembling. The water was dimpled with tiny waves. The bottom row of monitors displayed an X-ray of a skull with a tiny implant curled up inside. In addition to data oozing out, like an oil spill, the image showed wavering tendrils trying to get in. Then an explosion rocked the entire bridge. The debris raining down from the fireball where the helicopter had once hovered clattered off the roof of the C-144 fuselage that housed Times Square. J-Bone shouted out the door.
Yo, stations! Y'all know the drill! An attack! Come on!
Shinji's team had fired its first heat-seeking Thermidor missile. J-Bone pulled at Jane.
Come on, Jane! Jones will either get it or he won't. He don't need you, but we do. Look!
Jane pointed to the monitors. The tendrils exploring the image of Johnny's head had found an opening. In the chair, Johnny was almost smiling. On the leftmost of the monitors, to one side of the Japanese cartoon superhero, a face was appearing, as of someone approaching through a thick snowstorm. A woman. The second explosion knocked Johnny out of his chair. Jane rolled over on the floor to cover him. Jones's pool rocked with the blast, sending waves over the rim and onto the floor. Jones himself began to scream, terrified squeals breaking through the air. He began to swim in small circles like a convict pacing his cell. One of the ultrasound scanner towers collapsed slowly, folding like a flower at night. Jane! It was Johnny. His eyes were open. He was bleeding from his mouth and one ear, but he seemed somehow stronger than before. He got up and pulled Jane to her feet. A low-tech pulled J-Bone over to one of the security surveillance monitors. It showed a low-tech screaming silently, nailed to an improvised wooden cross. J-Bone ran out the door, followed by the rest of the low-techs. Johnny sat down with his head in his hands. Jane sat beside him. Suddenly, a strangely formal voice penetrated the gloom.
Mr. Smith?
A dark-suited man stepped out into the cool electronic half-light. A 357 pointed in their direction. To Johnny, it all seemed dreamlike. Whoever you are, I know what you want. The data. That means you can't shoot me. Takahashi smiled.
Not in the head.
He bent over to set down the cryo unit he was carrying in his left hand. He then shifted the gun to his left hand. With his right, he pulled out a short sword. Jane moved forward, coiled to leap. The light on the sword flickered, and she thought for a moment that he was already swinging it. But it was the monitors. They were flickering, all in strange unison. Suddenly, they all carried the same image. A middle-aged woman with short, dark, brown hair, yin and yang earrings. Her voice came through the missile-damaged speakers.
Takahashi! You! Are you everywhere?
The woman didn't answer his question.
You don't even know what he's carrying in his head, do you? You fool. You have no idea what you're returning to Pharmacom. He carries the cure to nerve attenuation syndrome.
You lie!
Takahashi raised the 357 and fired three times. Three 19-inch screens exploded. Three images of the woman disappeared. The woman's face on the other monitor softened, with what might almost have been pity.
They had the cure a year ago, Takahashi. It was not necessary for your daughter to die.
No!
Takahashi threw down the 357. As it clattered across the floor, he raised his sword with both hands and brought it down onto the central control console. Jane and Johnny both ducked as the room flashed bright with a shower of sparks, then grew dim again as all the monitors went blank with static and snow. Takahashi raised the sword for the second strike, poised over Johnny.
Don't!
Johnny said. It struck him as foolish even as he said it. Takahashi opened his mouth as if to speak. Then, wide-eyed, he fell to his knees. The sword rang like a bell as it hit the floor.
Hello, Johnny.
As he spoke, Shinji was holstering his pneumatic pistol inside his black nylon jumpsuit. He peeled his mask off his head. Behind him, a second Yakuza, still masked, scanned the room with an airgun pistol. Shinji unscrewed the tip from his thumb and shook out the filament.
Didn't think we would meet again, did you?
With a twist of his thumb, coupled with a short arc of his arm, Shinji swung, Johnny ducked, and the filament sliced an ellipse from the back of the chair where Johnny's head had just been. Johnny backed away, reaching behind him on the ground, searching in arcs for the 357. Instead, he found Takahashi's sword. He almost smiled as he held it up in front of him and stood. And his smile disappeared as Shinji swung again, and the sword Johnny held became a stump with an elaborate ivory handle. Johnny dropped it and backed up against the wall. There was nowhere else to go. The third Thermidor missile split the Times Square control area right down the middle, separating the space into two almost equal parts. One half of the room was still secured to the bridge frame, and the other, barely balanced, ripped open, rocking, tipping down toward the river 110 feet below. Johnny held on to a twisted bunch of cable fibers like vines. There was nothing under his feet but pure, empty night, and he was swinging out over the darkness. Johnny looked up toward the blown open end of the steeply tilted fuselage that had been Times Square. Shinji, a worried look on his face, was crawling down the littered slope, hanging onto a steel beam that was wedged into the rubble, extending his hand.
Hold on, Johnny! I'm coming!
Johnny suddenly laughed.
If I fall, you don't get the head. If I fall, you're fucked, right?
Johnny had the distinct feeling that his life was almost over. But what the hell? At least the universe had a sense of humor. Jane got to her feet unsteadily on the buckled floor. One end of the room was wide open to the night. Jane walked to the edge and looked down. She was amazed. The Yakuza they called Shinji was crawling out on a beam toward Johnny, extending his hand. A rescuer now, no longer a destroyer. She suddenly felt a big, cold, ham-sized hand clamp over her temples. And squeeze. She heard the voice just before she blacked out.
Jesus time!
Johnny could feel the cables popping and stretching. Just as they were about to give way altogether, he swung in and grabbed the beam above Shinji. The roles were reversed. This time, it was Johnny who crawled out on the beam from above and extended his hand. Shinji reached up hopefully. Johnny took the wrist. Just behind the thumb with the unscrewed cap, Shinji relaxed his grip. But instead of pulling Shinji up, Johnny gave the wrist a little flick. Shinji's eyes widened as he saw the bright flash of the filament slicing through the end of the beam. There was a long moment of silence, and then the night was loud with a single scream. Then, silence again, sudden and total. Hooking one giant hand in the waistband of her tight black jeans, Street Preacher dragged Jane across the tilted, buckled floor to the two timbers that had caught his eye. They had been thrown up by the force of the missile into the form of a cross. Perfect. He slapped her up against it with one hand. With his other hand, he searched behind him in the rubble, found a steel plate that would do for a hammer. Finding the other was harder. My kingdom for a nail. Johnny pulled himself up the beam to the still stable half of Times Square, stepping through the blown-out wall onto the floor, then jumped back in horror, almost falling. Takahashi! Johnny had thought he was dead. And he almost was. The Yakuza executive's crisp white shirt was soaked through with blood from Shinji's darts. Takahashi staggered and reached into the pocket of his suit. Johnny crouched down, expecting a gun. Instead, Takahashi held out a piece of paper torn from a fax.
Yours.
And he toppled over, blood bubbling from his lips. Johnny took the paper from his hand and unfolded it. It was a riot scene, scanned from the Beijing Evening News. Image number 2 of the download code, but one more still missing. Then Johnny heard singing behind him, a deep, bass voice.
In the blood, in the blood, in the sweet everlasting blood of the Lamb.
Johnny whirled around. Jane was against the wall, one hand nailed to a makeshift cross, and next to her, a white-haired man, the man who had attacked the step van outside Spiders. Johnny picked up a 4-foot section of pipe and was already swinging it like a baseball bat. The pipe connected with the back of Street Preacher's head. Instead of going down, Street Preacher turned slowly, his skull ringing like steel, which indeed it was, since one of his myriad cyborg enhancements included a cranial protection rim. His eyes were like tank headlights. His steel teeth grinned a lethal grin. Before Johnny could swing again, Street Preacher had plucked the pipe from Johnny's hand and hurled it. Jane screamed,
"Run, Johnny!"
But it was too late. Street Preacher had fallen to his knees, but not to pray, to fight. He had Johnny by the foot. He stood up, swinging him like a rag doll, and swung him spinning toward the shattered wall. Johnny hit the wall, head first. Jane winced, with the data overload crammed in his head, inaccessible. But the odd thing was that as Johnny slid down the wall, unconscious, he began to weep like a child, even as what might have been a smile was spreading slowly across his face. Johnny was having another dream. He knew it was a dream because his mother was in it, and his mother only existed in dreams. Her face was always a blank. Johnny had erased her face,
erased his memory of her. Even in dreams, it couldn't be recovered. But in this dream, something in his brain took over, moving in on the woman's face in stages, like clicks, isolating the woman, click, the head and shoulders, click, the face. She was younger, but he recognized the sad, searching eyes, the yin and yang earrings. It was the woman who had appeared on the TV in Beijing, and just a few minutes ago on the monitors before Takahashi was killed. It was the third image. Johnny's eyes snapped open.
I've got it!
Street Preacher smiled.
Wrong! It has got you!
Street Preacher took the cross from the chain around his neck and flicked it open into a knife.
Salvation! He has made you the vessel of his mercy. Where can the sinner hide?
Street Preacher raised his knife and approached Johnny, backing him into the corner. Johnny closed his eyes. At least he didn't have to watch.
The cure is mine!
The nail was stubborn. Without a crowbar, it took some doing to pull her hand free, but she did it, and headed for Jones's tank. She jumped on the rim of the tank, swiveling the cone-shaped antenna of the single remaining ultrasound scanner toward Street Preacher. As she turned it, a thin trail of destruction traveled across the floor where it had been pointed. A bottle melted. A paper snapped into flame. The plywood floor charred and smoked. A fallen monitor heated, hissed, and exploded. The trail of ultrasound reached Street Preacher just as he was about to bring his knife down on Johnny's throat. To Johnny's amazement, Street Preacher began to dance. It was involuntary. As the silicon subdermals, the muscular augmenters, the myriad implants that had been embedded in his joints and muscles began to explode.
Dear sweet Jesus!
Street Preacher lifted his hands to shield his eyes, but even his eyes exploded. Street Preacher lurched blindly, grabbing the end of a cut power line to keep from falling. As the blue-white current surged through him, Street Preacher suddenly straightened, standing full height as if at attention. Then he fell to the floor. 20 minutes later, a certain rough calm had been restored to what was left of Times Square. Jones lay peacefully in his tank. Johnny was in the chair. Jane was beside him, holding his hand. J-Bone called to the low-tech on top of a ladder.
How many monitors we got left, brother?
3. I'm just turning them on.
The room lit with a new glow, but instead of snow, a face came up on the monitors. It was a woman's face. The woman with the yin and yang earrings. Johnny stared at the monitor.
You're the third image. Your face was captured from the TV in Beijing. Who are you? Why do you look so familiar?
I'm your mother. My name is Anna. Anna Kalman. I died 6 years ago, but before I died, I had a neural scan performed, and my personality was imprinted into the neural net. Pharmacom arranged it so I could continue to advise them. I was head of Pharmacom. We were developing the cure for NAS, among other things.
J-Bone glared.
And holding it back?
That too. I'm not proud of that. In fact, I've done what I can to change it.
Johnny spoke as if he were dreaming.
You're my mother. My father?
I got you at the bank. I wanted a child. Thought I wanted a child. But I was too obsessed with building Pharmacom. I had no time for you. I shoved you aside. When you became a teenager, you ran away, and I let you go. Later, when I was dying, I found out you'd had your memory erased. It was too late for me.
Johnny shook his head. Too late.
Still, I tried to look after you, Johnny. I arranged that they would choose you as the courier. I've always tried to look after you.
If you're my mother, why didn't you let me know you were the third image?
Because I did not know. I had no access. That was just a mistake. The scanner must have picked me up off the TV screen at the Beijing Hotel.
What were you doing on that screen anyway?
I was in communication with the scientists. I helped arrange the theft of the data. And Johnny, I arranged that they would use you to...
Use me? Is that what you wanted from me? To ease your conscience?
Johnny didn't wait for an answer. He turned his back to her. J-Bone, I'm ready for the download. Let's do it. I have all three images now. I don't even need Jones. All I have to do is make an access run. J-Bone shook his head.
It's not that simple anymore. See, the data's still there, Johnny, but it's corrupted all to hell. The seepage has linked it to every other part of your brain. The procedure will probably kill you.
Jane took Johnny's hand.
Johnny, don't.
Johnny reminded himself that what was in his head was the cure.
Hit me, J-Bone.
Chip. Found. Opened. Free. Johnny cut through, watching pieces of himself float upward. Fall upward toward the light. Reach down. Didn't find the initiating macro. Was the macro. He was the universe running a self-test. And all around, peeling up in great spirals, data sweeping upward in perfectly ordered streams. Downloading Pharmacom data. The first thing Johnny saw when he opened his eyes was Jane. She held out both hands. He took them and staggered to his feet.
Did we? Did it?
Jane nodded. Above the console, the image of his mother, Anna, was still there. Just barely. She was smiling. Just barely.
Johnny, you made it. Did you get the data out?
We got it. What's happening to you?
It's Pharmacom. They're erasing me. Revenge. Just glad that I...
Glad that what? But she was gone. Johnny felt Jane's hand on his arm. They walked to the shattered end of the room and looked over the shoulders of the low-techs at the reddening sky. In the distance, to the west and south over Newark, rockets were rising. Flares. Car horns. Johnny turned to J-Bone.
What's going on? They're celebrating. I put out the news. We did it. The cure belongs to everybody. It's done.
Done. Johnny looked back at the monitors where his mother had been, and then down at Jane. He opened his hand over hers, and as he did, he felt his heart opening, like a fist. It was almost a new feeling, but familiar too. J-Bone watched them walk to the door.
Where you two going?
Down.
To see what's up.
Come, go with us. J-Bone smiled to the rest of the low-techs.
Why not? Can't hang around heaven forever.
Johnny Mnemonic, a novelization by Terry Bisson, from a screenplay by William Gibson, was read by Jack Noseworthy. It was abridged for audio by Harold Schmidt. The recording engineer was Patrick Torres at Mark Grau Recording Services, with editing and post-production by Jeff Stillman and Paul Stillman at Powerhouse Multimedia. Special sound design by Russell Burt. The associate producer was Florence Burrow Adams. Johnny Mnemonic was directed and produced by Arthur G. Insana. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Johnny Mnemonic is also available in book form from Pocket Books.